Do you hear me? Good.
Now, the question is, do you hear me now? No?
They might.
Yes. That may be a problem. Then maybe if I stay here, is it better?
Yeah.
Should be. Maybe I can even move the microphone because the cable is pretty long. So I can try like this. Now it should be much better.
Yeah.
Okay. So we use the backup solution as well. So I hope now you will be able to follow this. We should continue with the lecture today, since next Tuesday I might not be available because I have to be in Lillehammer for some private reasons. So today we shall have a lecture, and then next week you will have two exercises, so on Tuesday and on Thursday. Everything in this room. On Tuesday we have this in K113, unfortunately without the Omnom system. But it will be an exercise. Yeah. Held by Ambika. I might be present, but I cannot guarantee. Okay, so 2 days ago we talked about search algorithms in general, and now we are going to see how the search algorithm, a particular one, is applied in Snort and many other things about Snort. So we now concentrate on three open source intrusion detection and network monitoring systems, Snort, Bro, and Suricata. Some parts might be pretty technical, so not much scientific and not the master's level, but you have to know something about the technical part as well. So, these are the subtopics. First, something about the fundamentals of Snort, then its building blocks, data preprocessing, the detection module, and logging and alerting. So these three building blocks are the most important. Then something about how we can deploy Snort in a distributed architecture, very important for cloud and things like that. And then some post-installation adjustment of Snort. We might not finish all this today, but when we stop, we shall continue next time we have our lecture. The week after next week, there will be no class because there is a conference, SRX, in Oslo, European Security Conference, where everybody will be. So, because of that, you will not have class at all. So, that's the between 11th and 15th of September, so the 12th and the 14th, no class. Okay? So, we continue after that. We have enough terms for completing the course. So, we start with the Snort fundamentals. Snort is a typical and very widely deployed representative of misuse-based intrusion detection systems realized in software. It's open source, network-based, and misuse-based. So, network-based and misuse-based. So, it belongs to these two categories. We talked about that in our first lecture. It's widely deployed and studied, and why? Because its architecture is publicly available, it's open source, and the signatures that are the vital part of it, they are regularly maintained. There is a company doing this. So far it has been called SourceFire, and now they belong to Cisco, so they bought Snort, but it's still open source. Signatures are easy to understand because they look very much like ordinary English text. You're going to see many examples today and in next hours. They are written in text files. We are going to explain that. And they are human readable and easily editable. You can change the parameters as you wish. The ideas behind Snort are used in other intrusion detection systems like Bro and Suricata. the two that we are going to use, but the commercial ones as well. Different implementations, of course, are used for better efficiencies. Snort is not very efficient, let's say. First, it is realized in software. The second, it doesn't support threads currently. There is a, we are going to discuss that. There is a Snort 3.0 project, but it's in the alpha stage of development. It's not ready yet. You can try it, but there are many issues there. So if you want to deploy it for some real work, it should be Snort 2. Current version is 2.99. So it should be almost 3. Okay? In these other systems, there might be usage of threads. For example, Suricata does the same as Snort. So it's regarding the architecture and structure, it's a clone of Snort, but it supports threads. It's much faster. It uses the same signatures as Snort. So they are compatible. They can build their own, but they can use the Snort signatures, and this one is faster. We are going to talk about this system in particular later. Then the signatures or rules, how they are called in Snort, they are maybe encoded in a different way. For example, BRO is a network monitoring system that can be configured to be misuse detection. It can also be anomaly detection. We are going to discuss that. Now, they have signature-based part. So it's not only their own patented way of treating traffic, but also signature-based, but their signatures are quite different. But they are also misused if configured so, and they are signature-based, but with different format and different... They use regular expressions in the signatures that Snort and Suricata do not. So, Snort is slow. We are going to discuss that further. But there have been some measures to speed up the signature processing in Snort. First of all, we are going to study these special data structures where the signature reside after starting the system. These RTNs and OTNs, rule tree nodes and option tree nodes. We are going to discuss that later today, which are constructed right after the Snort system starts before processing any packets. The consequence of this, or let's say a problem related to this, is that it has more memory consumption. So it consumes more memory because of these structures. So they actually load all the rules before starting processing. Everything is in RAM. Otherwise, they would have to read from disk, and that would be slower. And to build these RTNs and OTNs, they need some initialization period that may be pretty long. On the exercise next week, you will see that once you start the command Snort, you have to wait a bit before it starts processing packets. And this a bit is a couple of minutes before it really starts doing what it is projected for. Or designed for. Snort doesn't use threads, and these are planned for the future. There is a Snort 3 project, which is in the Alpha 4 stage. If you go to their web pages, I visited them yesterday, so they are still in the Alpha stage. So, unfinished. Many improvements are in this Snort 3, at least planned compared to the Snort 2. One of the most important is the thread usage, so which will make it faster. But there are many other things. The concept has changed. How can we use Snort? We can use it as a packet interceptor, or as they say colloquially, sniffer. That's why it is called Snort. A packet logger, where you log everything that you receive, and as an IDS, and recently IPS. In the packet intercepting mode, it displays directly on the console the content of every packet that traverses the communication line, so as any other sniffer. So this is from 1999. So at that time, there were not so many sniffers. So they wanted to make a new one. And then they developed the concept to log what they sniff and to analyze these packets somehow. So you will see in Blackboard, I have uploaded the original paper. That's from 1999, where snort is described. In the packet logging mode, the packets are logged in non-volatile memory, let's say, on a hard disk or whatever kind of permanent memory, instead of being displayed on the console. And of course, we are not interested in packet logging and sniffing. We are interested in network intrusion detection mode, where each packet or session is inspected against the database of misuse, which is the rule files. That's what we have in store. It also has IPS functionality, where we configure the system in such a way that it is inline. So the traffic goes through the system. You don't just tap the network. You have to configure it this way, in such a way it can block unwanted traffic. The packet inspection in Snort is carried out by comparing the contents of the packets or session, usually a session, because it's a packet. By packet, it's not very good for detecting all the attacks, especially in protocols like HTTP, so where you transmit a lot of packets at a time. So we usually study a session. So we compare the content of these sessions with the list of attack signatures that are contained in a special misuse database, which is actually a set of text files that are called the rule files. And if indicators of suspicious activities in the traffic are found, they generate what they call alerts. When we talk about BRO, the BRO alerts are called alarms. So I shall use the terms that the authors use. So in Snort, when we talk about Snort and Suricata, we talk about alerts. And when you talk about BRO, we talk about alarms, which is the same. From the very beginning, Snort has been capable of monitoring a fully saturated 100 megabit per second network, but that's the technology of the last century. Now we have gigabit networks everywhere. At home you have gigabit networks, so fiber and things. So this is too slow. Now they try to speed it up, so after 300 megabit per second it didn't work. And didn't work so well. And after 500 megabit per second, it was useless. So it dropped everything. So packet drop is a problem. So when you have too much traffic in the unit of time, so they just cannot cope with that. Now the newest versions of Snort concentrated on improving the speed. So they improved the implementation of the search algorithms. They changed the search algorithms. They reconfigured the detection module, and now they claim that it could be run on gigabit networks, which I doubt, but it's faster than before. In addition, and this is pretty recent, it can run as an IPS, which is now called, before it was called Snort Inline. Now it's not called Snort Inline any longer, it's now called Snort Active Response, which is inline operation. And they have added some special instructions in the rules to handle suspicious traffic, like block. So usually it's alert or something, but we shall talk about that. Once you install Snort, you have a number of rules that are pre-installed, and they are designed to be general for all networks. Now, what is a general network? We don't know. There is no such a thing. That's a problem. Because of that, you will have probably a lot of false positives. We are going to precisely define what is true positive, false positives, false positive, false negative, and true negative later in this course. But intuitively, it's when you have an alert but you don't have an attack. So it's a false positive. And that's a big problem in intrusion detection. We have already discussed that before. Because of that, the IBS operator is supposed to write new rules or specific rules for the defending network and exclude the rules that are not necessary in the network. In such a way, we reduce the number of false positives, and the last part of this lecture will be about how to do it. So, a lot of false positives. The typical cause of this is that, for example, if you run Windows, you will also get Linux alerts, something like that. So that's trivial, but you have to exclude these rules. Otherwise, you get an alert if such traffic is launched against you. And why is this possible? Because of these robots or script kiddies that just try to find any vulnerable target. But if you are really a target, planned target, it is less probable that somebody will launch an attack against an operating system that you don't use, because they first discover what operating system that you use. So that's less probable. But this will not save you against robots, so-called web crawlers. Because of that, to reduce the number of false positives, we have to modify the original rule setting. We can do it by adjusting some of the original rules to the specific network environment conditions. So we can change some rules. Edit text files, that's possible. It's safer, of course, to copy an old rule and modify the copy. Now, we can add completely new rules. We can delete some rules. We can ignore some traffic by making so-called pass rules that are, as we are going to see, exactly the same as the alert rules, although they do the opposite. They let the traffic meeting these conditions that are described in the rules pass, not alert. And this is a great work. So once you install, you will have to invest some effort in post-installation adjustments of Snort for two reasons. To reduce the number of false positives, that was what we have already mentioned, but also to reduce the number of drop packets which cause false negatives. This is even worse, because in the drop packets an attack may hide. So we have to prioritize reducing false negatives first, and then we concentrate on false positives, and this is exactly what we are going to do. I'll talk about that at the end of this session. The components of Snort follow a typical IDS scheme that we have seen before. The packets are captured externally, usually through this interface that is called libpcap. Pcap is the device, let's say, and the library is an interface. You can call routines to communicate with the network interface card. What is the advantage of this? It's platform independent. It runs on anything, including Windows and all these operating systems that are used everywhere. The disadvantage is that it can process one packet at a time, which is not suitable for high-speed networks. So this is slow. And originally, it only could use libpcap. Now, in the new versions, it uses this duck library that has an abstraction layer that ensures platform independence, but it can capture many packets at a time, so in some configurations. And these configurations are like AF packet, which is similar to pcap but with better performance, NFQ or IPQ for IP table packets. This is used in IPS operation, because IP table is a firewall. IP tables should be an S here. IPFW, it's on BSD, Unix, so Berkeley system, whatever. This is Unix. The same thing, firewall. And dump for testing various inline features. So these all systems are for IPS. But AF packet is for IDS. The default interface is still pcap, so if you don't say anything, it will still be pcap, even though you use duck. Actually, you are required to install duck before installing Snort. So that was fundamentals of Snort. So you got some idea about what it is. Now, let's go inside and see what are the basic blocks of Snort. So we have the data preprocessing block, which actually consists of two sub-blocks. One is called packet decoder, and the other is called preprocessors. It's a battery of special routines that have to process traffic and adjust it to the needs of the detection module, which is the core component of this IDS as it is with the others. And finally, we have the logging and alerting subsystem that actually filters out these alerts that are produced by the detection module. The output is alert, it can also log, it can also block traffic if configured to be IPS. So let's talk about each of these components. First, packet decoder processes the raw packets collected externally, for example by PCAP. It extracts specific protocol elements for each packet. What elements? The ones that are relevant for intrusion detection. It starts with data link layer protocols like Ethernet, continues with network layer like IP, and finalizes with transport layer protocols like TCP and UDP. Actually, Snort never works with application protocols, at least the current version. So that's the top is TCP. So you will never get an alert from HTTP, from a rule. But there is a preprocessor for HTTP. The result of packet decoding is a specific data structure that contains elements of the protocols that are relevant for intrusion detection, as we have said before. Then we have preprocessors. We are going to talk more about packet decoder, but for now we just explain what each component is. The preprocessors are actually programs that prepare the packet data in order for the detection module to interpret them correctly. It performs, some of these preprocessors perform normalization, which means converting of formats, and defragmentation and canonicalization. We have talked about canonicalization last week on the exercises where we saw what the problems of UTF-8 to Unicode conversion can cause. So that's why everything is converted to Unicode. Some of the preprocessors detect attacks by themselves, like the port scan, SF port scan, SSH, DNS, ARP, spoof, etc., etc. There are several of them. And there are some special preprocessors that monitor system performance and try to improve efficiency, but there are also some other special preprocessors. We are going to talk about them as well. So normalization resolves for small changes in attack signatures that could make the corresponding attack invisible if left like this. For example, backslash and slash, like this. Image slash BMP and image backslash BMP, that should be the same. That's the same signature. But if you leave it in the raw format, it may be missed. If your signature is for backslash and you get slash, it will not react. So such things. This is a trivial example. There are more complex examples, but this is what it is. Then defragmentation and canonization interpreted Unicode characters in resource identifiers, in requests. The detection module is the principal component of Snort, which matches packets against the rules. We have said that. If a packet which sometimes is several packets, actually many times, and this is called a session. If it matches any rule, then we get an alert. Otherwise, just flush this traffic from memory and load new packet or session. The matching is exact. This is very important to notice. So a single bit of change in traffic makes Snort not detecting actually the same attack. Because of that, if you only have detection module, then it's easy to evade the IDS. To reduce the probability of this, we use preprocessors. But of course, they are not a silver bullet, so they don't solve all the problems of this kind. Finally, we have the logging and alerting subsystem, which forwards alerts to the operator. It logs the relevant traffic and alerts, and it can do it in many ways. It's very flexible about how to perform these actions. The outputting is relatively slow, and because of that, it has been improved recently to outsource the outputting operations to other applications. We are going to say something about that a bit later. Because of that, we save the resources for the detection. This is what Snort was designed for. So, let's concentrate on each of these stages: data preprocessing, detection, and logging and alerting. So, most of this lecture is about how this works. Start with the data preprocessing, which actually consists of two subphases: the packet decoding block and the preprocessor block. And we first concentrate on the packet decoder, which, as we said, extracts the values of different protocol fields, and those values that are relevant are extracted. They are also stored in special data structures that are further used by the rest of Snort. Each supported protocol has its corresponding record, which contains the values of the protocol fields. It's very similar to what another IDS Suricata does. The packet decoder first decodes so-called root protocols. They are analyzed first. And these root protocols are Ethernet, point-to-point protocol, point-to-point over Ethernet. For decoding on loopback devices, we have this null, and we have raw. So what is important for us is Ethernet. So that's 99.99% of the cases. From these root protocols, the chain decoders are invoked. And they are these: address resolution protocol, Ethernet loopback. This is not wireless LAN, this is virtual LAN. IP and IPv6, TCP, UDP, ICMP, etc. In this order. So it would be, as we are going to see, first Ethernet and then IP and then TCP, for example. So the chain decoders, such as IP, are invoked from the root decoders. And then from them, you can invoke the transport protocol like TCP or UDP. Here is an example on the slide 28. The chain decoder for the IP protocol is invoked from the root decoder for the Ethernet protocol. We can say that. And then, depending on the value of the protocol field in the IP header, the next chain decoder will be invoked from within the IP decoder, which will be probably TCP in most cases, but sometimes UDP, sometimes even ICMP. So this is supported, but not the application protocols like HTTP. So that was about the packet decoder. Not much to say. We are not going into details how this extraction of fields is done. You can look at the source code. Because the IP and TCP and UDP headers, they are very well defined, so you can very easily find these elements. Not only Snort, you can use Wireshark. You can use Bro, for example. Bro has a very nice packet analyzer, and it logs everything. You can discover all the elements, extract them, and you can even configure that. It's very interesting. But only technical, so there is no science in that, just programming. Now, the preprocessors. We know that the detection module cannot handle all the variations of input traffic efficiently. Because of that, we have several preprocessors in SNORT, which improve flexibility and efficiency of the overall IDS. And why is that? Because they have modular nature. You can switch them on and off if you don't need them. Most preprocessors perform data format adjustments. And why is that? Because IDS evasion techniques are about this. Small details, for example, how defragmentation is performed on various operating systems. Because I said this in the first lecture, the protocols that are used, the TCP/IP protocol stack, for example, it's not standardized. You only have what is called request for comments. That's not an ISO standard, which everybody has to stick to. Because of that, if you take two different operating systems, there are small details that are different in various aspects of implementation of these protocols, like defragmentation, and that's typical. I have uploaded in Blackboard, and you can read about this target-based defragmentation, fragmentation reassembly. This is how it is called. Also, TCP is sensitive to this. So TCP protocol is implemented differently on different versions of the same operating system and on different operating systems. The same holds for IP, and it's especially defragmentation that is sensitive. Now, fragmentation is something that is very much exploited in attacks. And because of that, the IDS can be evaded by means of these protocol implementation subtleties. And because of that, we have preprocessors to prevent this. But that's one group of preprocessors. There is another group. Some preprocessors detect intrusions by themselves. We are going to see that, like SF port scan. So how can you write a rule for a port scan? It's difficult. Then we have special preprocessors that, for example, monitor system performance. That's performance monitor. Or they can detect in cipher traffic. Unfortunately, SNORT is not capable of analyzing in cipher traffic. You have to decipher it before using SNORT on it. And some of them anonymize data because the law, especially in the US, and the authors are from the US, it forces the companies to anonymize data. So they cannot use personal identifiable information in their work, and they have to remove it. They must not log it, at least. That's why they introduce anonymization preprocessor to do that. Now, one can ask him or herself, did the designers of SNORT think about what is relevant for intrusion detection? What features or traffic are relevant in intrusion detection? The explicit answer is no, but implicitly they did it. Because in some attack detecting preprocessors, they actually use the features of attacks that are relevant to discovering them. But they didn't think as machine learning specialists. So if you present an IDS to you as a machine learning system that recognizes normal traffic or suspicious traffic, at least classifies traffic into two categories, good and bad, you can think about an IDS like this. In that case, you have to determine first what features of traffic are relevant for this classification. Now, the designers of SNORT, of course, didn't think that way. They thought more technically, by experience, so that they use expert knowledge. But maybe the features that they have been using are not an optimal set of features. They might detect the same attack with fewer features. So that's why this feature selection is a very important process. In the next topic, we are going to discuss this. So when we talk about anomaly detection, there they used a lot of machine learning techniques, but they can also be used in misuse detection. So there are three functional groups of preprocessors: data normalization preprocessors, attack detecting preprocessors, and special preprocessors. The data normalization preprocessors, their primary role is to perform technical format adjustments of traffic, and sometimes this also takes into account the subtleties of implementation of protocols, and in such a way, like this target-based fragmentation reassembly policy for IP, prevents IDS evasion attacks, of course, some of them that exploit these differences. The functionality of these normalization preprocessors may also include detection of some attacks, but we are not going into details. You can read the Snort user manual. That's pretty interesting to read, where they describe these preprocessors to the smallest detail of it. Each of these preprocessors has hundreds of parameters that can be configured. The next group is the attack detecting preprocessors that perform intrusion detection by themselves, like SF4Scan. So I have mentioned one, and this one is actually important. And special preprocessors, this encryption, detection, and privacy, and performance, etc. So regardless of the functional group where a preprocessor belongs, its functionality may depend on the functionality of other preprocessors. The basic preprocessors are frag and stream. You see, frag is IP defragmentation preprocessor, and stream is the TCP and UDP defragmentation preprocessor. Now, when we talk about UDP, we always talk about sessions, because the UDP protocol doesn't have anything. It's very, very simple, but TCP is complicated, so you can consider packet by packet. That's called, if you consider traffic packet by packet, that's called stateless processing. Otherwise, it's called stateful. So let's concentrate on the data normalization preprocessors. We know that new attacks appear very often, and the methods of IDS evasion constantly evolve. And there is a possibility that Snort either does not detect such attacks or does not detect them efficiently. So it's more efficient to write a separate preprocessor than to design 100 rules for the same thing. Because of that, these data normalization preprocessors have been included in the Snort architecture. In the beginning, Snort didn't have preprocessors. So if you read the paper from 1999, they don't talk too much about this, but later they introduced this in order for these things to be taken into account, IDS evasion. So these preprocessors normalize data in such a way the detection model can interpret them properly, and they also detect anomalies in protocol implementation that are often exploited in attacks, especially this fragmentation. And here is an incomplete list on the slide 35 of these preprocessors. We are not going to talk about them all. If you are interested, you can read the Snort manual, where you have all the necessary details. What we are going to talk about is frag and stream. So frag is the IP defragmentation module, which also handles some IP implementation subtleties on different operating systems. And this is called target-based fragmentation reassembly. And there is a paper about that in Blackboard. You can read it. By the way, for the exam, it's only the slides. There will be a lot of literature, but that's also only for your information. So if you want to know more, you can read the papers. So I will ask you what is in the slides. I think it's more than enough. Okay? So this preprocessor actually detects some anomalies in IP fragmentation. The current version is FRAG 3. It has been that for years. They didn't do any more than FRAG 3, which is improved FRAG 2. It is implemented in a different way by means of these hash tables and linked lists. And because of that, it's faster. Speed is everything, as we said, in IDS. So this target-based fragmentation reassembly that we have been mentioning so far, it's aware of the operating systems that run on the host in the defended network. So target-based means that it first determines what is the destinational traffic. And then it finds out what operating system is at the destination, and then it treats fragmentation as it should be on that particular operating system. That's target-based fragmentation reassembly. Why this? Because there are attacks exploiting the fact that different operating systems assemble the fragmented packets in different ways. That was frag. Now stream. Stream is something that has been rewritten recently. So they had like stream 5. The same as frag 3, it was stream 5 until last year. And then they actually introduced this session preprocessor that didn't exist before. And then the session and stream, they now have the functionality that was in one preprocessor, stream 5. This is a technical detail that you don't have to know, but stream preprocessor is has the function, one part of the functionality of the X-Stream 5 preprocessor. And what is the functionality? The functionality is TCP reassembly, but also UDP traffic, which is treated in the form of sessions, and it is also reassembled in the sense that all the packets starting from one origin and going to one destination, the same port, they are put in a row, and that's considered a session. And why is that? Because you have to analyze what is in this session, you have to search through it. So it must be a contiguous set of packets. We also have subtleties in TCP and UDP implementation, and because of that, we have this target-based TCP reassembly policy. It's not now fragmentation reassembly, it's TCP reassembly, where reassembly is performed according to the way the host in the defending network to which the packets are directed to does it. So if it is Windows, then Windows. Windows 10, Windows 10. Okay. Also, ICMP messages are monitored by means of this preprocessor. What it does is to detect destination unreachable and service unavailable messages that terminate TCP and UDP communication. This may be interesting for SF port scan. And because of that, SF port scan and other preprocessors, they all require that stream and frag are activated, and they are by default. So you don't have to think about that. But sometimes you can deactivate them for whatever reason. That doesn't sound very logical, but maybe you have some particular application in mind for which even frag and stream consume too much computing power. Who knows? Because in theory, you can treat this traffic on your own. You don't have to use the preprocessors. You can write your own preprocessor. So ICMP also handles, the ICMP part of the stream preprocessor handles implementation subtleties on different operating systems. So there are various protocol anomalies that could be exploited in attacks. So frag and stream are very important. These are basic preprocessors from this category, data normalization. And of course, now you have this session. We are not going to talk about that. But session and stream are together form this old stream file. Now, we said that from rules, you can only react to up to application layer protocol, so not the application layer by itself. For this, you need a preprocessor, and that's HTTP inspect, which decodes the data buffer, finds the HTTP fields, normalizes these fields, integrates with stream to handle sessions, not only packet by packet processing. There are many session-aware features. Now, Snort was notorious for not doing this. And in the new versions, they are capable to do that. So actually, before the processing of HTTP was stateless. So they processed HTTP packet by packet. Now it's stateful processing. So they didn't have this, and Suricata had that, etc., etc. So that's why Suricata took a lot of market for Snort. The primary role of this preprocessor is to normalize traffic directed to web servers because they run HTTP, and also to discover anomalies in HTTP protocol implementation, which also exist. Let's have a break.
Does Snort interfere with the traffic or only monitors it?
Sorry?
Does Snort interfere with the traffic, for example, drops packets on purpose if it detects an attack, or does it just monitor, and if it finds something suspicious, it's only giving an alert?
It can be configured to work as an IPS. Why cannot I stop this? Strange. It is recording. We don't have sound on this. And then it disappears. So why did that happen? One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four. This should work, but it doesn't. It works, but it didn't work in the plus. Okay, we can only hope that this omnum will work. In any case, I have video and I have the sound separate. So as you asked, you can configure Snort to work inline, which means to serve as an IPS. You can block that. But by default, it's only IDS, it's only alerts. If you don't say anything, it will be just IDS. Why on earth it didn't record the sound?
There was sound on the home note. So.
That's true if it worked.
Yeah, they said it worked.
Good. Okay. Am I too far away from the mic? It shouldn't be the case. Because once I moved there, it stopped recording.
it only recorded the video. So it's probably the case that I have to be in front of the microphone, which is very strange. It is directed somehow, unlike this one.
You can test it, just walk around by recording.
That's true. I'm going to do that exactly. So let's try. This is another test in which I am walking around and see what will happen if I move to the usual position. So is it now recording? Who knows? Let's try. Let's try again. Did the sound appear? Let's see. Okay. It is, actually. It is recording. So why didn't it record then? And then it disappeared. There is no sound. Terrible. Crazy things.
There is always something. Spørsmålet er ganske generelle, hvis du leser, og han sa at de kom til å bli med det samme, hvis jeg forstod det riktig.
Ja, det er jo
litt. Kan jo ikke være veldig, veldig, det tre timer. Nei, kan det
eksamen jeg tar her. This light on again. That's what I said, it would be a problem.
So, shall we continue? By the way, today at 12:45 we are going to finish, and then I recommend you to go together with me to the room G303 where we have the testimony seminar, and topic for today is search. So it will be my lecture 1 hour about search, and then two of the PhD students of mine we'll talk about their research in search, approximate search and constrained approximate search in digital forensics in general and intrusion detection in particular. So, of course, you are not obliged to go there, but if you like, you can follow me and then you can listen to this. We finish about 4 o'clock. Yes?
Is it in English?
Sure. It is in English. And we have some audience from police. Okay, so let's try again. So the first hour was without sound in this particular private recording, but Omnom, it should be good. Now let's try and see how it will perform this time. We started explaining the data normalization preprocessors, and now we have the normalizer. And the normalizer's role is very closely related to the IPS operation. So it has to help preventing successful application of IPS evasion techniques. It will alert on or drop packets with suspicious encodings. And these encodings are normalized. IPv4 and IPv6, ICMP and TCP, the supported protocols. So that was the first category, the data normalization preprocessor. So we have seen that there are several, but the most important ones are FRAG, STREAM and HTTP INSPECT because of the massive usage of these protocols, IP, TCP, and HTTP, and also normalizer. But in the Snort manual, you can read about the others, because they are also used. The next category are attack detecting preprocessors, whose primary role is to detect attacks by themselves. And for these attacks, why should we have preprocessors for this and not rules? It's either not possible to define signatures, or for various reasons. We are going to see at least one example for this. And it is difficult to do. So you have to write many signatures instead of one preprocessor. Port scanning is, for example, difficult to write rules for. These attack detecting preprocessors are listed here. So SF port scan on the slide 43. SF port scan is the most important one. And then we also have SSH, DNS, ARP spoof, SIP, interestingly enough, for telephony, etc., etc. So there are others as well. So they always add something from one version to another, because this system is evolving. We are going to concentrate on SF port scan first and a lot. We are going to talk more about SF port scan, because port scanning is an important reconnaissance activity. We discussed that before. This SF port scan preprocessor detects ordinary port scans that are typically generated by some tools like nmap that we mentioned before. The main assumption is that in normal communication, when you launch traffic to some destination, you will probably do it to an open port. So negative responses from hosts as a consequence of closed ports are not usual, especially if you have a lot of them in relatively short time. And that's how SF port scan works. It detects such situations. So it detects and keeps track of such negative responses, and that's how it works. We can categorize port scans depending on the number of hosts that perform and receive scans. Like one-to-one scans, we have seen that on our last exercises. That's easy to demonstrate. Then we can have many-to-one scans that are called distributed scans, or we can have one-to-many scans that are called also port sweep of or horizontal scans. In addition to this, SF port scan detects decoy versions of those port scans, which are port scans where the source address is spoofed and the destination address is real. So this decoying helps attackers hide their identities. So let's see these one-to-one scans first. That are traditional scans that are performed by a single host and directed to a single host. And SF port scan detects TCP, UDP, and IP scans. So the traffic can be ICMP, of course, by default, but also TCP packets, UDP packets, and IP without any protocol, just data, raw data. That's possible. So you can send data by IP. That's strange, but it can be done technically. Then we have many-to-one scans in which many hosts query a single host for open ports. Why should anybody do that? To evade IDS, for example, or to obfuscate commands and control hosts in a botnet. So in a botnet, you have command and control the master of the botnet. SF port scan detects the same TCP, UDP, and IP distributed scans, also ICMP, sure. Detection is performed through the target host for easier tracking, because it's many to one. Okay, so it's easier to monitor the target than each source. Finally, we have these one-to-many scans in which one host scans a single port on many hosts. Why should anybody do that? Because when there is a new attack, somebody is looking for victims that have an open port, and this particular port that is vulnerable on that particular version of the operating system or any software that controls the port. Once found, you launch the attack. SF port scan can detect such a port scan, but the port in question should normally be closed. Okay, so if you have port 80 and you run a web server, so the port will be open and such a thing cannot be detected, because SF port scan only detects when the port is closed. Okay, so if your port 80 is open and vulnerable, and somebody is looking for a vulnerable port 80, this is just a trivial example, but it can be some other port, then it's bad for you, because SF port scan will not detect it. Because the response from the requirement, from the request, would be, okay, acknowledge, not reset. Then we have filtered port scans, where either the destination or the ISP suppresses these reset messages. And that's called port scan filtering. And why is that? Because of prevention of port scans. The target will simply drop the incoming port scanning packets. It will not reply at all. Usually, when you have a normal system, if the port is closed, this reset or reject will be actually sent back. But if the port scan is filtered, then actually it doesn't have to do anything with the attacker. It has to do something with the victim. So the victim doesn't want this reset to be sent back. So that's possible to do, in which case you would like to detect even the port scans that are filtered. You can do it by monitoring the target. So SF port scan detects, again, IP, TCP, UDP, and ICMP filtered port scans, distributed port scans, and port sweeps, which means many to one and one to many, but filtered. So this can be done. So this was something about the SF port scan. We are going to see that in the exercises, how it works when we run Snort, because port scan is not harmful by itself, so we can launch as many port scans as we like in the lab. It will not make any damage. We can play with this in the lab, otherwise if we launch some attacks, there might be problems. The next attack detecting preprocessor that we are going to discuss is the SSH, which detects several exploits or vulnerabilities of the SSH service, which are these four at least that are treated in this preprocessor. The challenge response buffer overflow, the CRC32 attack, the secure CRT attack, and the protocol mismatch exploit. So for these, it's difficult to write a rule. Why? Because the rule would have to react on the size of traffic. So this is something that the rule cannot do. So the rule can say, okay, I have found this substring in this packet, and that's bad. But it cannot say, I have found that after establishing SSH connection, it is now in cipher traffic, and 20 kilobytes of traffic has been sent immediately after the establishment of connection. So you cannot do it by rule. So challenge response buffer overflow and CRC32, they are similar attacks. They are the victims are different versions of SSH. they occur after the key exchange with SSH, and because of that, the corresponding traffic is enciphered and cannot be detected by a snort rule. That's one of the reasons. But you can still detect the attack with the preprocessor. The SSH preprocessor detects such attacks by counting the number of bytes sent to the server. In both attacks, challenge response buffer overflow and CRC32, more than 20 kilobytes of data are sent to the server immediately after the authentication challenge. And why is 20 kilobytes? We have seen before in our trivial buffer overflow example in the exercises, we had to try to provide the input string that is pretty long, like A, B, 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 etc., etc., and somewhere around N, there was a buffer overflow. Now, this particular buffer overflow is after 20 kilobytes of input. And the vulnerability is known because the SSH version, I don't know which, maybe two, in this case, the vulnerability has been discovered by trial and error. So they tried to launch a long input against this and it crashed. So the preprocessor generates an alert if the byte count exceeds a limit defined in advance, which is 20 kilobytes, in a predefined number of packets. 20 kilobytes, it's more than one packet, obviously, because one packet is 1.5 kilobytes at most. The SSH version string is used to distinguish between the challenge response buffer overflow and the CRC32 attack. For version 1, it's CRC32. The challenge response buffer overflow is for SSH version 2. And this is that attack. And then the two other attacks, secure CRT and the protocol mismatch attack, they can be detected before the key exchange. So it's on open traffic. So this was about attack detecting preprocessors. I have mentioned two, there are more, but we are not interested in everything. It's a lot of technical story. There are also special preprocessors that do not detect attacks. They do not perform format adjustments. So they are doing something special. And they may provide capabilities of blacklisting, whitelisting, for example. They can monitor performance of the system. They can detect if the traffic is enciphered, because when it is enciphered, you don't have to waste resources of snort to this because it cannot analyze them. Then it can ensure privacy protection of the defending clients. Sometimes they decode special protocols like these mobile telephony protocols or SCADA protocols, which enables writing rules for detecting intrusions in such networks. And here is the list on the slide 56 of some of these preprocessors, like reputation preprocessor, performance monitor, SSL TLS, sensitive data preprocessor, GTP, Modbus, DMP3. So GTP is for mobile telephony, Modbus and DMP3 are for SCADA networks. Let's say something about some of them. So reputation preprocessor provides basic IP blacklisting and whitelisting capabilities. So it works much like a firewall. It can drop, block, or pass traffic from a list of IP addresses that you specify. It runs before other preprocessors and solves the efficiency problems of implementation of reputation in rules. So before they did it by means of rules. The IP list to block, drop, or pass are loaded from external files. And you can have many such lists. The performance monitor is something that we are going to discuss later in more detail, but for now, we say something very general about it. That is a preprocessor that measures the real time and the theoretical maximum performance of snort. Performance is everything, as we have said before. It will print statistics of system performance, like timestamp, packet drop rate, if any, data rate on the wire, number of alerts per second, etc., etc. And you can configure Snort to change the results of these measurements. It can report events. For example, this one is very important, so-called non-qualified events to qualified events ratio. What is a non-qualified event? That's when you evaluate the rule and it doesn't match. So actually you wasted the resources. And the number of qualified events, the number of rules that were evaluated and matched. Now, of course, if you are heavily under attack, this number of qualified events will increase. But if you are less under attack, the number of non-qualified events may be too high. Now, what to do? We can reduce testing. So we can do something about it, in order not to waste resources, not to drop packets. So we are going to discuss that. In order for a misuse-based IBS to be efficient, the non-qualified events to qualified events ratio should be as small as possible. So ideally it would be one, but that's impossible. So that means that every packet is an attack. If it is not the case, the system has to be adjusted additionally, because what you do with testing these rules is just wasting of resources. The next special preprocessor is actually detecting whether incoming traffic is in cipher. So this is SSL TLS preprocessor. If it is in cipher, such traffic cannot be analyzed by Snort, unfortunately, and because of that, you shouldn't do it. Now, the preprocessor monitors the port 443, which is reserved for enciphered traffic. A session is considered enciphered only if both parties are sending traffic that is enciphered, which means the TLS or SSL session has to be established first, and then you count how many bytes have been exchanged and something like that, and it should be enough bytes. Because otherwise, everybody could fool this preprocessor by sending only one side traffic that is enciphered. The next one is the sensitive data preprocessor, which detects and filters PII, personal identifiable information, which should not be processed by law, by the detection module, or recorded in the system. This is something like credit card numbers, US social security numbers, in Norway personal numbers, email addresses, things like that. So it has to be anonymized somehow. You can customize this, you can define what you want, you don't want recorded, and you can include other information into it. The next one is the GTP, decoding preprocessor. GTP is GPRS tunneling protocol, which is actually extremely important, and it is now used everywhere in mobile telephony. The 3G and 4G use this. So you first have IP, then UDP, you see, and why is that? Because radio takes care of error correction in mobile telephony. So you don't need TCP. Which is actually good, because UDP is very efficient. So radio solves the problem of synchronization, etc., etc. So you don't need that. Now, the mobile telephony data transmission has to be compatible with wired data transmission. And you do it by means of this GTP that comes after the UDP in this chain, and then after the GTP, you can transmit the normal internet traffic as if it were wired. So it will be IP, TCP, HTTP. Okay, so what you see when you transmit data through a mobile phone is HTTP, for example, but you are not aware of this part, IP, UDP, GTP. So that's below the thing that you see, IP, TCP, HTTP. That's what you see. The rest is transparent for the user. You can, of course, look at it, but that's advanced. Now, this preprocessor, GTP, decodes the protocol, GTP, and extracts the encapsulated IP, TCP, HTTP. This is what you can analyze in Snort. There are two subsystems here. One is the decoder. We don't care about this because it's not a preprocessor. But it extracts the data, IP, TCP, and HTTP. And we have the GTP preprocessor, which enables writing rules as if they were no GTP, so as if it were wired transmission. The next two are for SCADA networks. So Modbus, for example, is one of these protocols, and the preprocessor decodes the protocol, extracts the protocol fields, and then you can write rules for Modbus. Or DMP3 is another protocol for SCADA, the same thing. So this preprocessor will enable you write rules for networks using this protocol. So that was about preprocessors. Now we concentrate on the detection module, whose purpose, of course, is to perform this search for attack signatures in the packets forwarded to it from the data preprocessing module. If there is a match, then we have an alert. So that's the basic operation of any IDS, in particular misuse-based IDS like Snort. Now, we have said before that Aho Korosik is used in Snort and many other systems as default search engine, and why it was that we explained. But implementation is specific. Now, in Snort, there were time optimization and space optimization in implementation of Aho Korosik. First of all, the default implementation is NFA. So we have explained the algorithm on the NFA. And we know that there may be several next state transitions per input symbol. This is simulated by this implementation of Snort. Or we can have DFA implementation, where you always have one next state transition, but then the graph is complex. The data structure is complex, and it consumes more memory. You can always get DFA from an NFA, and we have said that. And why should we do this? Because it is possible, in theory, to have this gain 50%, which will not happen in Snort. And why? Unless you are heavily attacked, that will not happen. So if you are not heavily attacked, then since you are looking for patterns that are characteristic for attacks in your traffic, most of the time the machine will be in state zero circulating and looking for the first character of the pattern that you are looking for. And the number of these patterns is slow in normal traffic. So not many such patterns, unless you are a military base that is heavily under attack. We are going to discuss this further when we talk about testing IDS. And if you remember, in the first lecture, I mentioned that IDS systems, under some circumstances, are useless. And we are going to mathematically prove that. But it's too early. The DFA implementation is possible in Snort, and you can compile it like DFA. We expect to have 10% increase in performance on average by using DFA. In return, we consume a lot of memory to store the graph. Now, how do we do this? We construct a special function that is called next move function delta, and we eliminate the failure transitions. We actually pre-compute them. So by making this delta, we pre-compute the failure transitions, and then we always have one transition for one input character. A deterministic finite automaton consists of a finite set of states S and the next move function delta, such that for each state small s from the big S set of states and input symbol alpha, delta of S alpha is a state, so it's never fail. So in the NFA you have either delta of S alpha is some state, or, well, not delta but G, or it is a message fail. Now we have converted fail and G, F and G into delta, and we eliminated F, and we eliminated failure transitions. DFA always makes just one state transition on each input symbol. How to do this? We start from the go-to function G and the failure function F, and then we construct the next move function delta by pre-computing the transitions from the failure. The time complexity of the conversion algorithm is linear in the size of the set of search patterns, how many patterns. Okay, so that's not a problem. The conversion is easy. And here is the algorithm on the slide 73. Of course, we are not going to do this, but we can illustrate on an example how this works. So if you look at one of our previous examples, and that's actually Snort on Snow. And if I open the previous presentation, we have had this algorithm. Snow, snort, and off. So we are converting this machine and the next move function, the fail function into the next move function. So let's look at it. So for example, the current state is 0. If an O arrives, it will go to 7. If an S arrives, it will go to 1, to the state 1. If anything S arrives, it will stay in 0. That's exactly what is in G. You see, if an S arrives, goes to 1. If an O arrives, goes to 7. For anything else, it remains. So you actually study all the cases and put them in the delta function. For example, for 1, what can happen? You either get an N or O or S. So if you go to the state 1, you can get an N, you can get an O. You see what happens if an O arrives and you are in 1. You consult the failure function. So you are in 1, it says go to 0, okay? And then from 0 it will try to match O and it will go to 7, okay? Etc., etc. That's actually encoding 3 transitions into 1. And that's this one. If S arrives, it will go to 1 because there will be another failure function. Let's see. So we are here and an S has arrived. So what then? We go to 0 and then try to match S, so 1 again, you see? So you go to 1 in this case. All the others will take you to 0, etc., etc. So you do that for all the states. So this is how the algorithm for the conversion works. So you get for state 2, for the state 3, for the state 4, state 5, state 6, state 7, and state 8. So that's what you get, the delta function, in which case you can use that function, which is obviously a lot of memory, this table, for even a small case, but it will be more efficient because there will be no more than one transition at a time. So that was time optimization. So you optimize time consumption by using DFA. Now you can also optimize space. And why is that? Whether you do NFA or DFA, in both cases you can optimize space. And why is that? Because these tables and matrices, they are sparse. So they have a lot of zeros or F fail symbols in them, and you can save some space by special encoding rows. So NFA, for example, contains a lot of fail values in the G table. So when I say table and you have seen the graph, you can encode the graph in the form of a matrix, and the matrix is called neighborhood matrix or adjacency matrix. You see, where you put a 1 if two neighbors are adjacent and 0 if they are not. Well, in this case, fail plays the role of 0. In the DFA implementation, you have a lot of zero values because from some state most of the transitions include zero transition. So for example, from that one state, if an N arrives, it goes to 2. If an O arrives, it goes to 1, if an S arrives, go to 0, etc., etc. So that's 3. And then all the rest, it goes to 0. So it will be a lot of zeros. To keep that matrix is very inefficient. It's so many zeros. You don't have to do it. You can use what is called the banded row format, and this is what is used in SNORT. Of course, this is very general. You can use any other technique for saving space. I'm just mentioning this because it is really done in SNORT. It is required that random access to the elements of the matrix should not include any search, so it must be fast. So you save space, but you have to save time as well. Because if you can, there are other methods of saving space, but to consult an element in this matrix, for example, if you use a linked list, to address an element in a linked list, you have to traverse the whole chain before that element. So that's search. Well, a kind of search. So using pointers that point to the next element, etc. So they don't do it in SNORT because that would consume time. You save space, but you waste time. So that's not the point. The point is to save space and time as well. Because of that, the banded row format that is used satisfies this. What is the bandwidth? It's the number of elements of the vector, which is a row of a matrix, between the first and the last non-zero element, all inclusive, and in between can be zeros, but we cannot save space on them. But we can save space on leading zeros and trailing zeros. So the zeros before and zeros after the bandwidth. In the case of NFA, fail is the same as zero. We treat it as a zero. In the banded row format, the first number is the bandwidth. The second number is the index starting from one of the first non-zero element of the vector. And then the bandwidth elements of the vector are listed. Okay? And here is an example on the slide 84. If the vector is like this, this is a row of a matrix. Okay? So you have five zeros before the first non-zero element, and then after the last non-zero element, you have six zeros, which is a lot. So we can save space. We can save 11 elements minus 2, because we need two numbers for the banded row format. So in the banded row format, you will have the first number, the second number, and then the bandwidth. So these elements, the last elements, are exactly these ones. So 7028 1004. So these three zeros and this zero, we cannot save that. We have to put them in the shortened vector. But the bandwidth is 9. The bandwidth is the long length of this part that is non-zero. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So that's the first number, so we cannot save that. We have to keep that number. Now the 6 is the index of the first one. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So the starting index. So these two numbers, otherwise we would save 11 here, but we save actually 9, because we have to keep these two numbers. So the bandwidth and the starting index. And in general, if the vector, original vector, is V1 to Vn, where n is the dimension of the vector, we can shorten this, and we can put these two numbers, b and I, and then v1 prime to vb prime. Okay, so there are b elements here, and these two numbers, b and I. That's exactly what we had in this example. And how do we address v on I given y prime of I? Will be v prime of I minus I, big I, plus 3. In this example, if B is 9, I is capital I. And small I is 8, that's what we want to address. So what is V of 8? So V of 8 will be V prime of 8 minus 6 plus 3. So 3 is a constant, 6 is the first index. You see, so if we want V of 8, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, this number 2, it will be computed by means of this formula. 8 minus the index of the first one, which is 6 in our case, and just add 3, and that will be v of v prime of 5, which is 2, because v prime of 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's exactly this 2. Now, what is the danger here? The danger is that this calculation, by means of an error in coding, is wrong. So if we get this index wrong that we look for, we can put, for example, 16 here, which is over the buffer. So that will cause the buffer overflow. Because of that, the boundary check is necessary. And that's something that reduces the performance. If you don't provide boundary check, there is no performance waste in banded row. But then you have to accurately program, which is not guaranteed. So you have to provide the boundary check. Now the boundary check, since snort is implemented in C, must be given. So there is no garbage collector or such a thing that would keep track of this. So you have to do it manually. So that was about time and space optimization. What remains is some implementation details. Both DFA and NFA of the AHO Corosic are present in snort. So you can compile snort to be DFA. DFA consumes more memory, even if you save space by means of the banded row format for matrices. And in addition, it's not always banded row format. Sometimes it saves space, sometimes it trades this for time, etc., etc. It depends on many factors. But anyway, the default implementation is NFA because it consumes less memory. Because of that, snort is best for environments where low memory consumption is important. Now, this is a system from 1999, originally. And at that time, memory was much more expensive than today. And the PCs didn't have so much memory. Now you have a normal office PC with 32 gigabytes of RAM, so which is pretty cheap. Everybody can deploy snort on this with DFA. So we can try that. I have personally never tried, but NFA works quite well. If memory consumption is not critical, we can compile it for the DFA implementation, and it will be with banded row format for the next move function, etc., etc. In the default NFA implementation, NFA is managed as an array of linked lists, so not of integers. Now, we can convert it into a full or sparse format NFA depending on the number of transitions on an input symbol. Why is that? Because if you have a lot of transitions, then it's better to have a matrix. Because as we said, linked lists must be traversed in such a way that you read everything before the symbol that you need. That's low. If this number is higher, this number of transitions is higher than a threshold, which is defined in advance, then use full format. That would be faster. Even if the NFA is processed in the sparse format, the zero state transitions can be stored in the full format. Why zero state transition? Because most transitions are zero state transitions. Because you are not heavily attacked. So most transitions will be from zero to zero, more or less. In the NFA implementation, the goto function and the failure function are not separate. They are merged. And for each state, the state word is followed by the transition list for that state. It can be done. So it's a kind of optimization. We are going to discuss that also in the Suricata case. So that's what they also do. Each transition and failure state is then replaced with the start index of the transition state. And the NFA array is in addition compacted into a single vector, which means that's easy to understand. So you put vectors one after another instead of putting them in a scheme that is rectangular because it's faster. But then you have to compute the index in each row. But that's easy. That's trivial. In the implementation of a pattern matching algorithm, the number of search patterns, length of the search text, and the size of the CPU cache affect the performance of the detection module. We have discussed that last time. Performance of the DFA implementation and the NFA implementation in full and sparse format depends on the problem at hand, which means on the rule. Sometimes a rule is better processed with the DFA than the NFA, and sometimes it's the other way around. It depends much on these factors. So, for example, the number of search patterns, that depends on the rule. So the rule defines. The length of the search text doesn't depend on the rule. It depends on traffic that is analyzed, so you cannot influence this. The size of the CPU cache, of course, it can be taken into account because you know on which platform you install. Let's have a break and then we start with the snort rules.
No, it didn't work. So something is wrong with this. It might be that maybe the loudspeakers or something. So something must affect these recordings, that the camera that is inside, that is my private, it doesn't record sound. Once I press this button, it stops recording sound. I don't know why.
Anyway.
Yes, but it also has a microphone. So this microphone should work, and it works in the beginning. And then when I move there and start recording with this, it stops. Why is that? I have no idea. Because it has never happened before. I used this camera in the room K113 where we had the class before and worked perfectly.
Is this device sending per Bluetooth or something like this?
No.
It's just
the local device without any connectivity, which is... I don't understand that at all. cryptology. They are crazy. That's from 2016. How did you check that this all works?
On streaming, for listening, Higg and all.
Yes, I did that.
Click
and then slash publish. Streaming.
Yeah.
31st of August, maybe there is something that I did. No. But it is supposed to record.
No, slash live.
Yes, but I don't want live.
Oh.
It should be recorded as well.
Yeah, that's on publish.
Publish, yes, but it's not there.
Maybe it takes some time.
Uh-huh. Okay, we shall say then live. Because live... A153. That should be us, yes.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Now it's infinite, okay? But you cannot go backward. You cannot present what was before.
You'll be there after, probably.
It will be there after, yeah. Hopefully. Okay, so for some reason this thing does not record sound. It records the first 5 seconds of sound, then it stops, and then you only have video. Okay, anyway, we stop at 12:45. I plan to buy a new camera anyway, so the next time maybe I get a better one.
Now we start with snort rules. We have mentioned the rules many times, but now we are going to get deeply into this. The rules are written in an easy to understand description language. We are going to see how it looks like. It's easy to understand. They are stored in text files, and these text files are grouped according to types of attacks, protocols, services, etc. The main structural components of the rules are the rule header and the rule option. The rule header contains action that the rule triggers, for example, alert or pass. Then the protocol used in the analyzed packet, the source and destination IP address, and the source and the destination ports. The rule option contains the alert message sent to the console if the rule triggers, and information about when it triggers. So what are the conditions to trigger, and maybe some additional information that helps the user find information about the attack. And this is an example on the slide 95, a rule from the rule file webclient.rules. So you see, it is, these are grouped according to the type of attack. For example, alert TCP home net any to external net HTTP ports. The message for the operator, web client outlook EML access, flow from client established, which means established connection started by the client. Content, you see, EML, and this is a modifier to the content, HTTP URI, which means this EML is to be found in the header, not in the payload. Metadata is what is not rule any longer. Policy, security, whatever, IPS drop, reference, where you can find about the attack, class type. We are going to discuss what class type is. It's something about prioritizing alerts. Snort identification of the rule and the revision of the rule. So up to the metadata, it's actually when the rule triggers. Flow from client establish content.eml in the header. The rule header is the part of the rule before the list, the first left parenthesis, so up to this point. The action is alert. The protocol is TCP. The source IP address is determined by the global variable home net, whose value is defined in the configuration file snort.conf. The source port is any. The destination IP address is determined by the global variable external net, which is also defined in snort.conf. Destination ports are determined by the global variable HTTP ports, which is also defined in snort.conf, usually 80, but it can be many. We shall look at the snort.conf file in the exercise. The rule option contains the alert message MSG and the further information about the conditions to be satisfied in order for the rule to trigger. Flow, content, and the modifier HTTP URI. And sometimes instead of this content plus HTTP URI, you can meet in the rules the keyword URI content, which is the same. The rest of the rule option is information about the attack, reference, class type, and at the end you have the snort identifier of the rule and the revision, and that's something internal. The basic rule actions are alert, log, and pass. If you configure it to be an IPS, you have additional actions like drop, which means block and log the packet, or reject, which means block, log, and send reset signal to the sender if possible, if it's not a spoofed address. If it is, it will not be received. Activate and dynamic, these two are related with so-called dynamic rules. We are not going to talk about that. And sdrop, which is block without logging. You save some space with this. Snort, as we said, only supports these protocols, TCP, UDP, ICMP, and IP. Addresses and ports can be given as explicit numbers. You can configure them as variable names in snort.conf. And the operator arrow is called the direction operator, so where the traffic comes from and where it is directed to. Sometimes it may be bidirectional. And you will see in Bro, you can have the other way around. So you can have internal threats, but not in Snort currently. There are four categories of rule options. The general options, which provide information about the rule, but do not affect attack detection, like message, reference, etc., etc. The payload options that are actually related to search. These are content, URI content, etc. Non-payload options that analyze non-payload data in the packet, like frag offset, TTL, time to leave, etc., etc. Post-detection options, which define actions to be performed upon triggering the rule, like log to, session, etc. So there are many things you can do. And all these have many parameters that enable precise packet inspection. Now we are going to look at the implementation. Internal data representation of Snort rules, you have linked lists. Actually, there are three of them. The rule header is mapped into the rule tree node. We have mentioned that in the beginning. RTMs, these rule tree nodes, are chained into one dimension of the linked list. So that's one dimension. Each protocol, TCP, UDP, ICMP, IP, has its own linked list that consists of the corresponding RTNs. So we have several of these three-dimensional lists, but they are related to the protocol. Of course, the massive one is TCP. The second dimensional linked list is obtained from the rule options, and each rule option defines its own option tree node. So that's OTN. Several rule options can have the same rule header. The corresponding OTNs are chained under the same RTN. We are going to look at a drawing, a scheme. The third dimension of the linked list is a chain of functional pointers, so that these are entry points of the, let's say, programs that check some options in these option tree nodes. Each function pointer corresponds to one option, and they actually call these functions. And this on the slide 108, you have how it works.
That's 21st century technology.
So, RTN1 to RTNN. So for each RTN, is actually assigned to one source IP address, one destination IP address, source port, and destination port. So this source IP address can be home network or something like that. It doesn't have to be one single address. Also the destination IP address. Source port and destination port, that's usually fixed, or it's a range of ports that is given by means of numbers. Now, under each RTN, you have a list of OTNs, and to check each OTN, you have pointers to these functional, to these functions. So these are functional pointers. That's the third linked list. I'll give you an example. Every packet is first compared along the RTN linked list, the first dimension list, until a match with a particular RTN is found, if any. In the case of a match, the packet is further checked along the OTN linked list, matching this RTN, that's the second dimension list. And every OTN in the list must be checked until an eventual match is found, and the check is performed by traversing these third dimension linked lists, which are functions. So everything will be clear on an example. When an option from the OTN is found to match the analyzed packet, the current option checking function calls the next option checking function in the chain. So only if it matches. If any check fails, then the packet is checked against the next OTN in the second dimension list, which means the next rule. And here are two similar rules, and we are going to see how it works. So consider these two rules on the page, on the slide 112. The first one is alert TCP home net any to external net HTTP ports. That's actually for the RTN. Then you have message, web client outlook, EML access, flow from client established, content EML, .eml, HTTP. And the second one is the same, but you have message, web client, but not outlook EML access, but Microsoft EMF metafile access, flow from client established, that's the same, content is different, so it's .emf, HTTP. So two very similar rules. How this works in the RTN OTN lists? These rules share the rule header. It's absolutely the same. So RTN will be the same. So they will share the RTN. The OTNs will be different, and the functional pointers to the function will be the same. And why? Because you have content check in both cases, so it will have to invoke the search algorithm. So that's the functional pointer to the search algorithm. So that's an example, the option content. That's alpha coracic, etc., etc. So the functional pointer will point to that. To process these rules, NORT will first search for the RTN that is common to both rules, and then it will check the OTNs one at a time. And to process each OTN, the corresponding function pointers will be used, and the corresponding functions will be
invoked. And here is what it will do. So it will find home net, external net, any HTTP ports, that's the same for these rules. So it will match this and it will find this RTN that we have this. And then under this RTN, it's probably 200 rules, 200 RTNs, or maybe 2000, who knows, many. Now, we search through this linked list and we find, for example, this one. Flow from client established content.eml HTTP UI, which means check whether it is from client and established. That's the first functional pointer. Okay? And we say it is true. It's from client and established. Okay? Then check another one. Is content.eml in the UI, in the header? If it is, that's it. So that's this rule. Okay? If not, try another one. Okay, so it was true here, so we don't have to check that again, but maybe we do. So it depends on the implementation. We'll probably do it again. That's a potential for improvement, as they say in Norway. So that's for Bedrings potential, eh? For Snort. Then this may be true. If so, then check .enf. The content. If true, then that's this rule, which means this will be an alert and the message that will be sent to the operator will be web client Microsoft EMF meta file access, which is the application. So I hope you understand how this works. So that's two similar rules, and this is how these linked lists. There are three groups of Snort rules according to whether you invoke search algorithm or not and where you on which input string you invoke the search algorithm. So the first are no content rules, which are fast. Then you have content rules, which are slow, and UI content rules, which are slow but faster than content rules. Because of what? Because UI is usually shorter than the packet. You see, the number of characters in the search string also counts because it will determine how many times you are going to traverse the automaton in the Yahoo collision. Each of these rule groups characterizes the corresponding group of attacks. For example, some attacks can be detected by inspecting the packet headers only, like SYNFLOOD. That's a trivial example. But there are no packet payloads there at all. For detection of some attacks, inspection of the packet payload is necessary, which is a majority, unfortunately. This is slow and should be avoided if possible, because it would be non-optimal to use these rules if you can do it better. For example, some attacks may be detected by inspecting the implementation of specific protocol elements, which is usually the UI. So that was about the categories. In addition to the already made rules provided in Snort upon installation, it is possible to create custom rules that are specific for the dependent network. And this is sometimes necessary because you may have some false positives or packet drop. In some cases, it is possible only to expect the packet header. And here is an example on the slide 120, WinNuke. That's a very old attack for Windows 95, but the principle is what matters. So the possibility of denial of service through the NetBIOS port. The WinNuke is example of no content detection because the rule, which is on the slide 121, doesn't have content inside. But you have to check. Flow stateless flag is set in TCP. It can be U flag and maybe some others. This plus means that. And alert TCP external net any home net, but to this range of ports, 135 to 139.
And on the next slides, it is explained what it is. Alert is what, TCP is protocol, external net, any, etc., etc. We have seen that before. If the match is found, the message will be DOS-WNUKE attack. The keyword flow is used to explain the TCP stream reassembly behavior that is relevant for the rule. Stateless means that the rule triggers regardless of the state of the stream preprocessor. So, regardless of whether the connection is established or not, that would be stateless. The keyword flags indicates which flag should be set, in this case U, but maybe some others, and this is encoded with this plus sign. The interpretation would be: generate an alert on any TCP traffic that originates outside of the defending network and is directed to the ports 135 to 139 and has at least the flag U set. Unfortunately, for many rules, search in packet payload is necessary. For example, this one, netbios smb cd dot dot. Alert TCP external net any to home net 139, that's netbios. This is the message to the operator, netbios smb cd dot dot. Flow to server established connection. Content, you see, 5C, that's backslash. So backslash dot dot slash and then 00000 in hexadecimal. So these vertical lines, they don't exist in the string. They just mean that what follows is read as hexadecimal. So again, the fields that you already know. The value of the flow keyword indicates that the rule triggers on the traffic directed to the server after the established connection. The content is what matters here, and this is suspicious payload detection rules, because we have to invoke the Aho-Korosik algorithm to look for this 5C dot dot slash 00000. Everything has to be converted to either hexadecimal or character. So 5C is backslash, so we can say, but what to do with 00? It doesn't mean anything. So it's a special sign. Probably what it does is to convert everything to hex. This attack is an attempt to circumvent the directory access control by executing remotely the command cd dot dot. So that's something that we have seen in the exercise, actually the same attack, because of this canonicalization thing. The string that Snort searches for is interpreted as a system command. That's cd dot dot and then you do whatever, 00000, that would be the command. But it can be, you will see, if you list the rule files, you will find many rules actually having this first part. But the content is different. Any rule that inspects packet payloads requires search, which is slow. And because of that, you have to avoid this if possible. Unfortunately, it's not possible in many cases. And that reduces effectiveness of IDS and their ability to operate in real time, which is extremely important. Finally, we have these URI content rules. And here is an example on the slide 133, the semicolon bug. The rule for this, that's for Internet Information Server from the year 2000, very old, but there was such a bug. So web IIS multiple extension code execution attempt. You see, alert TCP external net any to home net HTTP ports, because that's Internet Information Server, web server. Flow established to server, so the order doesn't matter, so it could be to server established, that's the same. Now content, you see, dot ASP and then 3B, which is a semicolon, and dot. Must be there, no case, which means uppercase or lowercase, doesn't matter. HTTP URI, you see, so what you are searching for is actually this string, but in the header. So the content field, regardless of the case, is found, then the message is displayed, etc., etc. Now, the HTTP URI is what puts this into the category of unique content rules. But the algorithm for search is the same. The attack is called the semicolon bug. It's the known vulnerability of earlier versions of Microsoft Internet Information Server, which is a possibility for Internet Information Server to execute any extension as an active server page or any other executable extension, so-called semicolon bug, which is like this. On the slide 137, malicious.asp, and then you say semicolon, and then that .jpg, which means it treats it like a picture, like an image, but it's actually a code, it's a program. It will be executed. So you can drop tables or something with it. There was an extension protection, so ASP couldn't be executed by default unless you let it do it, but you mask it as a JPG. So any network traffic coming from the external network, which is intended for the HTTP ports of the defending network, whose URI contains .ASP3B, which is a semicolon, regardless of the case, generates an alert, and testing this is URI content testing. It's more efficient because the search string is shorter. That's why it is more efficient. In real situations, intrusion coverage better than the one obtained by generic rule set upon installation is needed, and you can write these rules, and these are custom rules. If we know the signature of the attack, if we know the attack, then we can write a rule. It's easy to write. It's clear for the user, but processing rules is slower because it's text files. There is some overhead in text. For example, if we want to alert on traffic from a particular URL, if we know that the host 194.147.191.33 generates suspicious traffic, whenever we find this, we alert like this. Alert TCP and then the address, any port, to home net, HTTP ports, or any ports if you like, message suspicious HTTP traffic, because it will be HTTP ports. We don't have to check anything else. So this will be a fast check. That's a custom rule. Any traffic signature can serve as a starting point for making a custom rule. You just edit it. That would be all for today. Now I'm recommending you to follow me and go to G303. And follow first my lecture on search, and then the two more lectures on constrained approximate search. In
Is it in total 1 hour or each lecture 1 hour?
Each lecture is 1 hour, so you finish at 4. But there will be breaks in between.
C'est quoi, il y a les yes. entre si les deux bits correspondent et pas si ceux-là qui vont se décaler.
J'ai galéré parce que c'était du MATLAB. Genre j'ai dû mettre 2 heures et 3 heures, tu vois.
Ouais.
C'était super chiant. Okay.
Fortunately, the audio works.
This worked, yes.
So you will have separately audio and video. But this thing will probably work. So after they stop recording, they will probably publish on this Omnom thing.
Oh, they are recording extra?
They are recording extra. That's possible in this room.
Okay.